honestly, actually, if you want to hear a strange fact about me, besides the fact that I've never tried coffee, I've also never listened to a podcast. Not once, not ever. There's this very American thing of do it yourself, do everything yourself, and I did this all by myself. It's actually even tied together with the whole follow your passions, follow your dreams. That's all tied together. It's like you. What do you want? What's your passion? What do what's best for you? You got to look out for yourself and make your own personal achievements. Talk about very American traits, feeling self-sufficient. You know, self-sufficiency is very American. Like when I first moved there, I said, "No, you've got to do what you want. It doesn't matter what everybody else wants you to do. You got to do what you want." And it took me quite a while and a lot of my Singaporean friends to kind of explain this point of view that no, that's just you being American. That's a very American thing to think that what you want is important. Don't focus on the problems. Who cares about the problems? Just focus on where you're going. If something gets tossed in your way, you just walk around it, step aside it, or just break through it. Who cares? And your friends go, "Whoa, I love this one. This is my favorite song you've ever written." You say, "What? Like that one? Like that was just some silly little effortless thing that just came out." And they're like, "Oh, no, this is the best song you've ever written." I like that we use the English word release for that, because it is like a letting go. Like, it doesn't belong to you anymore. It's out there in the world, and you created it for whatever reason you did, but the world is going to respond the way they want. It's theirs now. Whatever scares you, go do it. Whenever you're faced with a decision, ask yourself, like, is this scaring me? Therefore, that's the correct thing to do. I do think that recording your thoughts, whether in writing, audio, or video, and then publicly sharing what you've learned is one of the best things you can do for the world.
Good morning, everybody. It's Nate.
This is Doug.
This is Nate and Doug.
I'm Doug, and this is my brother Nate.
We have the Smile High Club, where the smiles just get higher and the club is just booming.
Making those smiles across the planet just a little bit higher.
We are probing the depths of people's human consciousness.
Best concise answer, Doug, is...
I am happy to be here.
A story about their joy, about their lives, about what drives them.
I just want to thank you guys for having me on.
The ultimate cheek workout and the brain massage.
This was just truly a delight. And it has been a fine way to spend a Sunday.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's going to be awesome party of awesomeness.
Welcome, everybody, to yet another edition of the Smile High Podcast Club. Today, I have wrangled somebody that, through his work, I respect quite a bit, his point of view on life and business and things. His name is Derek Sievers. Did I get that last name right, Derek?
Oh, Sievers, like rivers.
I knew I would butcher it. So Sievers. Thank you, Derek. And now this is a very special guest for our podcast. Derek, in fact, is 18 hours ahead of me. He's in New Zealand. How's the morning over there for you, Derek?
Gorgeous. I live right on the ocean by the big crashing waves crashing into some rocks. So, a perfect place to work at home all day.
Oh, and do you have a window that maybe you're looking out through?
Oh, of course. Yeah. I'm saying that as I'm watching the waves crashing into the rocks right in front of me. Yeah, it's great.
Oh, I'm so jealous. Very good. And that's Wellington, I think, if I've followed your Facebook.
Yeah.
Cool.
I live in the capital now.
Well, excellent. I actually spent 2 years of my life on an island just north of you there in New Caledonia. It's about
a
couple-hour flight. So I've seen those waves. I've seen that big body of water. I love it.
Were you there for 2 years?
I was there for 2 years basically doing like a service-type mission. And so that's what brought me there, and I would die to go back. It's a lovely place. So I'm totally jealous of you, Derek.
Cool.
Let me just give the audience a little idea about you, and then maybe you can fill in a bunch of the holes. Your resume, Derek, is rather extensive, so I don't even know where to start. Basically, how I got to know Derek is through a TED Talk that I listened to. I got interested in that. I bought his book. Derek wrote a book. Well, he's written like around 34 books. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So he's written quite a few. But I only read one, unfortunately, for now. And it's entitled Anything You Want. And that was back in 2011. And it became a number one Amazon bestseller in its category. It's a small book, but it's so dense. It's one of those books that that you look at, you read a page, and it's just full of great ideas for the entrepreneur, or even just kind of everyday life. Derek has appeared on three or so TED Talks, I believe. The three talks that I know about are How to Start a Movement, and no, for my audience, that is not a Bran Muffin commercial. This is a different type of movement that Derek was talking about. The second one is Weird or Just Different, and that's an interesting talk. Derek gives a few different perspectives on, you know, living abroad and seeing different cultures. The last one I know about is Keep Your Goals to Yourself, and it's basically some data-driven advice from psychologist tests and stuff. Derek also started a company called CD Baby back in 1998. This, in essence, is kind of where Derek brought home the bacon, so to speak. This company became one of the largest seller of independent music online. 100 million in sales, 150,000 musicians. I'm sure that figure probably has changed by now. Esquire magazine actually called Derek the last music business folk hero. So he carved out a rather interesting niche for musicians. I know if you look up Derek's website, which is DerekSivers.org, he gives a little rundown of what he considers himself to be, which is a professional musician, a programmer, a writer, entrepreneur, student, and the last thing, a circus clown. Now, I'm really interested about that, Derek. Is this something that you did way back when in your early days?
Yeah, from the age of 18 to 28, that was my full-time job. I was the ringleader MC of a circus. Yeah, got a gig originally. You know, I was just a professional musician, really making my living as a musician. And I got this call asking me to do a circus show. And they liked what I did. And they said, hey, we'd like you to be the new musician. And eventually that led into, you know, we'd like you to be the MC. We'd like you to be the main guy. So, yeah, it was a great performing experience. From the age of 18 to 28, I probably did about 1,000 shows on stage. And you realize if you can entertain a bunch of 5-year-old kids, you can entertain anyone.
That's true. It's probably one of the more critical audiences any of us can have, right? Well, excellent. That just seemed to be like the black sheep of all those credentials and titles that you had. I don't think many of us can say we've ever been a circus clown. So that's very awesome. And just to wrap up, I don't want to take all the time giving me audio bites. I want to get you on the horn here, Derek. But the last thing that I know about you, Derek, is you've started a company called Wood Egg. And I'm not too sure if the current project of the book that you're writing that gives a concise synopsis of other books is part of this company. Are they associated?
No. Wood Egg was a flop. It was when I was living in Singapore, I wanted to understand my new neighborhood better. Neighborhood meaning all of the countries around Singapore. I realized I knew nothing about Malaysia or Indonesia or Sri Lanka or Cambodia. And I really wanted to understand these places. So I just have a philosophy that you should share what you learn. So I thought instead of me just going around and backpacking and asking a bunch of questions, why don't I formalize this? So I started a publishing company called Wood Egg to share what I'd learned about these 16 countries around Asia. And Yeah, it was a huge flop. I spent so much money on researchers and writers and editors putting all these books together, and had a great system. It was kind of like a bookmaking factory that we used to put this all together. And in the end, man, some of those books, like the Guide to Sri Lanka, sold like 5 copies.
Oh.
It was like kind of amazing, you know, that I'd spent like, I don't know, $15,000 to produce this book and sold 5. I was like, wow, all right.
Dang
People
it.
Just weren't interested. Yep.
I think I went through the list of all of those, and I think I read about how you did it. You hired people who were from the company, or the country, sorry, and people who were visitors, and that's how you semi-outsourced this book, these books. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, I didn't want to just get one person's opinion, right? So you could go to Indonesia and ask one person a bunch of questions about Indonesia. You could say, tell me about this and tell me about that. And what you'd get is one person's biased opinion. And I thought, well, I'm a programmer. I can build systems. I love building systems. So instead, I built a system where I came up with 200 questions that I wanted to know the answers to. And then I made sure that every question was answered by 3 different people with 3 different viewpoints on the place. So I tried to find always one native person that just grew up there, one foreigner that was living there now but was not originally from there. And then ideally, some of my favorite ones, if I could get them, would be somebody that grew up there but then left for many years, like went and also saw the world from a different point of view, but then came back to Indonesia or wherever and could give me the perspective on Indonesia from having been gone as well. You know, I think that's some of the best perspectives come from that point of view.
I'd like to touch upon that, Derek, because it seems like in maybe your book or your TED Talks, you've made it a point to mention to get people out of their culture to see other people's culture. And is that right? Is that why that last person was so, and his perspective or her perspective was so interesting?
Yeah, I think that for all of us, you know, your 2 years spent in the Pacific, you know, that phrase that I heard about fish don't know they're in water. What that means is we often don't even know what our culture is until we leave it. We just have a bunch of things that we think are true. And it's not until you leave the place that you're from that you find out that a bunch of things you thought were true are actually just opinions, or they are the norms in your culture, but are very much not true in other places. And only then can you see them, like, you know, like the fish who jumps out of the ocean for the first time and looks down at it and says, whoa, oh my God, I'm in water. You know, then you can kind of, with that perspective, see your own culture with a new clarity.
Like you said, I did spend some time out of the U.S. and I know exactly what you're talking about. You grew up in California and have since moved out to Singapore, and now you're currently in New Zealand. Looking back at your mentality, Californian mentality, United States American mentality, what would you say the biggest idea that you held as a truth that actually turned out to be not so helpful or not so truthful?
Probably individualism is the main one. There's this very American thing of do it yourself, do everything yourself. And I did this all by myself. It's actually even tied together with the whole follow your passions, follow your dreams. That's all tied together. It's like you, what do you want? What's your passion? What do you, you know, what's best for you? You got to look out for yourself and make your own personal achievements. And so you go to a place like, I was going to say Singapore, but really it's true all across Asia, where the general belief is that what you want doesn't really matter so much. You do what's best for your group, and your group usually means your immediate family, but extends beyond that to your village or even your country. You do what's best for the group. And so, say, for example, in Singapore – there are not a lot of people trying to be musicians, for example, because the spoken or unspoken message from the parents is like, okay, you've got this thing that you like doing music. Okay, that's good, but we need you to get a good paying job at a multinational corporation because you've got to take care of your parents and take care of your family. This little cute passion of yours is nice and all, but we can't have you being broke because that's not good for your family. So make a lot of money, do this on the side for fun. You see what I mean? It's a very different message than you get in America with this kind of like, follow your dreams, follow your passion. So at first I thought it was wrong. Like when I first moved there, I said, no, you've got to do what you want. It doesn't matter what everybody else wants you to do. You got to do what you want. And it took me quite a while and a lot of my Singaporean friends to kind of explain this point of view that, no, that's just you being American. That's a very American thing to think that what you want is important. And finally saw it from that perspective. And I no longer think they're wrong. It's just a different way of looking at it.
Actually, that's one of those thoughts that I believe you conveyed in your book in a way that sent my house of cards falling down. I actually grew up, and it's not a bad thing, because I am all about getting those ideas to where I can, I don't know how to put it into words, but basically to live a fulfilling and potential reaching life, you know. The reason I'm of this mentality is I grew up listening to personal coaches like Tony Robbins, Dale Carnegie, Napoleon Hill, and a lot of what they teach, which is motivating, is all about you. And It can basically lead to a very frustrating life. Kind of like you said, if everybody's about you, I guess it's just not so rewarding. And so when I was reading your book, I don't know if I emailed you this or what, but I was like, wow, your book goes right for the jugular. You know, it really touched me and affected me to start looking outside myself. And so I really appreciated that observation. I mean, I think that, you know, as an audience listener, it's something worth considering to think of possibly revamping that idea and come from a more tribal or group type think of contribution mentality.
Yeah.
Well, excellent. Well, Derek, would you mind maybe sharing just a little bit about yourself that you'd like the audience to know? Who you are, where you came from, just a brief synopsis, and then we'll jump into the regular questions.
Sure. I'm very American. grew up all around America. Really just decided when I was 14 that I wanted to be a famous musician. And so that ended up being the best thing for me because it just gave me this focus. That's like now I had something very difficult that I was shooting for. And it's funny, it could have been anything. I could have wanted to be an Olympic gymnast or, you know, go to the moon or something. But it was just having a difficult goal, I think, is just one of the best things that a kid or a teenager or anyone can have because it put everything else into perspective. And while my friends would like sit around and watch TV and just kill time and go to parties and whatever, that I skipped all that stuff and I was just focused. I was a workaholic robot and I loved it because I knew what I wanted in life, you know, and that just developed some really good habits for me of enjoying working and all that. So from the age of 14 to 29, all I wanted was to be a successful musician. And in some ways I did it. I made a living doing music from the age of 18 to 28, 29, until I even bought a house with the money I made touring. And it was around that time that I started a little website just to sell my CD. But that's when some of my friends said, hey man, could you sell my CD through that website? Because at the time there was really nowhere else to sell your music. There was no There was no PayPal. Amazon was just a bookstore. It was a different world on the internet back then. This is like 1997. So, I started selling some of my friends' CDs on my band's website. And then that just grew and grew and became CD Baby. And that got much bigger than I wanted it to be. It had 85 employees and way too much responsibility. And it was too stressful. I was not enjoying it. So I sold it because I was just kind of miserable doing it. I sold CD Baby in 2008. And that's when I decided I wanted to be, turn my attention to more interesting intellectual things and became more of a writer speaker kind of dude. So that's where we are.
And what a cool dude you are at doing that. I think you're doing well. I don't know much about the CD Baby other than what I've read, but you're writing and speaking, you're touching people's lives like myself, and I'm hoping that that gives you the motivation to just keep going. I found it interesting, and I know you didn't include this part in the details of CD Baby, but I understood that you spent maybe 3 months creating a buy now button, which this is right before PayPal and all of that. What made you think you could do it? Because you had no programming skills up to that point. Is that correct?
Yeah, but I guess the belief system is like, well, this is a human capability. So if a human being can do it, then I can do it. I mean, how hard can anything be, really? We're not talking about some kind of supreme abilities, like, you know, I'm not trying to be an Olympic gymnast or something like that. But, you know, a buy now button, yeah, I have no programming experience, but how hard can it be? So, yeah, it was pretty hard, but I did it. It was 3 months of my life. Not so bad.
That's not too bad. I just love that viewpoint. It seems like you share a common viewpoint of me of why not? Might as well try it. Just really quick, my background, I'm a mechanical engineer. I work with jet airplanes. My math grades in high school were horrendous. And either I had a stroke of amnesia or what, but when I went into college, I decided to go into engineering. And even with my deficiency in math, I was able to do well. And it seems like perhaps maybe that's the entrepreneur spirit, that they look at things as challenges rather than huge obstacles. Have you ever hit an obstacle in your life where you're just like, it's not worth my time?
Yeah, probably daily, but those things don't really stick in my memory, if you know what I mean.
Like, yes, there's, yes.
Obstacles are a lot, they're just what you make them to be. You know, I know a lot of people who get really, really hung up on things and think of them as huge obstacles. And then other people just look at those same things and just bypass it. They just step right over it and don't let it get to them. You know, they don't give it more of a minute's thought, like, oh, all right, well, that didn't work. Let's try this. Mm-hmm. You know, whereas other people will just sit there and tell you their sad tale of how they tried this and it just didn't work. And that's why I'm here on Skid Row, you know. So I don't know. I think it's just a certain mindset that changes everything, you know, whether you have the mindset of being able to bypass problems, or just sometimes it's just ignore problems, you know, just saying like, okay, well, that's another thing that didn't work. Whatever, let's carry on. You know, I think that Tony Robbins' metaphor once is that he said when he was learning karate, he thought it was fascinating that his when he was learning to break boards, that his karate teacher said, ignore the boards, just focus on the point below the boards and just get your hand there. That's, you know, focus all your energy on that point behind the boards or past the boards and just ignore the boards. And he kind of made a metaphor for life out of that, that there are all these problems and just don't focus on the problems. Who cares about the problems? And just focus on where you're going. And if something gets tossed in your way, you just walk around it, step aside it, or just break through it. Who cares? So I think I adopted that mentality quite early, so that if you were to ask me about the obstacles or the problems or the struggles I had when starting my business, it's like, I don't even remember them. It just wasn't really a focus.
Yeah, I love that you brought up that metaphor. It's so outcome-oriented rather than excuse-oriented, where you're like, well, can't do that. I can't program a buy now button. I'll wait until somebody does it for me. So
yeah,
very, very cool. Very cool. Well, let's shift gears, if you don't mind, and we'll jump into these questions. I have so many questions for you, Derek, that I want to stay on track, at least for my my listeners who are expecting me to ask these questions, and I'm battling against time. So thank you so much thus far, but let's dive into our questions. Are you ready for question one?
Sure.
All right. Question one is to share a life experience that has made a significant impact on your life. And if you could share that and explain how you think it has contributed to the person that you are today.
Probably meeting Kimo Williams when I was 17, I think. I grew up in Chicago and was about to go to Berklee College of Music. Like, I had already signed up, I'd already enrolled. And I realized that I was going to be writing a lot of sheet music. And I went looking in the classified ads for like a music typewriter. And there was this teacher, Kimo Williams, that had a classified ad in the newspaper about music typesetting. And I called him and asked him some questions. And he said, well, why are you asking? And I said, well, I'm going to go to Berklee College of Music in a couple months. I think it was probably just 6 or 7 weeks away before I was going. And I said, I just want to prepare for that. He said, oh, Berklee College of Music, huh? He said, well, I graduated from Berklee College of Music and I taught there for a little bit. And I could teach you a thing or two before you go. I said, I would love that. And he said, well, show up at my studio here in downtown Chicago at 9 a.m. Thursday morning and I'll show you some things. So a couple days later, I ring his bell at 8:59 in the morning. I show up at the door and he was surprised to see me. I heard him tell the story years later. To someone else, he said, you know, I say this all the time to people that call me and ask a bunch of questions. I say, show up at my studio at 9 a.m. And he said, nobody ever does. And he said, for the first time in all my times of saying that, you know, this kid showed up at my door at 8:59 in the morning. And he said, that already was impressive. And so anyway, he taught me that. He said, look, I think you can graduate college in 2 years. He said, the standard pace, he said, you have to understand, colleges need to go at a standard pace so that nobody's left behind. You have a classroom full of people, and they really just need to keep their pace at about the level of the slowest student so that everybody can follow along. He said, but if you're smarter than that, and he said, and I think anybody can be smarter than that, then there's no need to go at the standard pace. There's no need to take 4 years to graduate college. You can graduate in two if you work hard. And he said, for example, and he sat down and just showed me a bunch of stuff. We sat at the piano and he said, okay, how does a major scale go? Okay, I went da-da-da-da-da. He said, okay, what is the interval between this and that note? What is this? Okay, now, do you know what a tritone is? I said, yes. He said, now, where can you make another tritone using those same two notes? I said, using this chord? He said, great, that's called a substitute chord. And like, choo, choo, choo. He was giving me all of this music theory. And Nate, it turned out that in 2 hours of intensive discussion like that, he had basically showed me two semesters of harmony theory class, of music theory class at Berklee. And then in another couple hours, he showed me the other two semesters worth of it. So right there, he, you know, helped me get out of 4 semesters of classes that I would have spent however many months of my life sitting in.
Right.
We did it in 2 hours. And then he did that for some other stuff and some other stuff. And I probably went down to his studio probably 4 or 5 times over 5 weeks before I went off to college. And on my opening day at Berklee School of Music, sure enough, I tested out of like, I don't know, 12 semesters worth of classes.
Wow.
And was able to graduate. I didn't graduate in 2 years. I graduated in, 2.5? Yeah. But the belief system was there that the standard pace is for chumps. That was his quote. That if you're more driven than just the average lump, you can do so much more than anyone expects, and that this applies to all areas of life, not just school. So I really think that I owe most of the achievements I've had to his raised expectations. That's all it took. So if any of your listeners are interested, I told this story with a little more detail on my website at sivers.org/chemo, K-I-M-O. And there's a link to him and his music and his studio. I haven't talked to him in a while, but I should. But anyway, we kept in touch. He made such a huge difference in my life that we've kept in touch ever since. That was, 20 years ago or something?
That's interesting, because that very thought makes us look or analyze our life and look at things that we've adopted, patterns or ideas or whatever that we've adopted because they were given to us. And I guess one could think, well, can this be done in a different way, or can it be done quicker? I can see why that had such a profound effect on you. Is that kind of that idea, is that what has made you pick up the project of condensing these books that you've been reading into ideas and easy to assimilate ways of life or looking at things?
I don't know if it's related. I'm just a learning addict. You know, I really, like you and like your listeners probably, I love learning and improving and constantly reading. For me, books really do it for me. Honestly, actually, if you want to hear a strange fact about me, mm-hmm. besides the fact that I've never tried coffee, I've also never listened to a podcast. not once, not ever. Books are really just my favorite format. I love to get away from the audio and just sit down with a good book. And when I do that, I tend to, if it's a paper book, I underline things and I circle paragraphs. And if it's a Kindle, they have a highlighting feature on the Kindle that you can basically do the same underlining. Regardless, when done, then I copy all of my notes into a text file so I can review it later. Because the big idea was, about 8 years ago, I realized that I would often forget the lessons inside the books I had read in the past. Like, I would remember it in the moment. You know, I'd be influenced by a book as soon as I read it. But then, you know, a year later, 3 years later, the lessons were gone. You know, they had just faded away. And I'd look at it, I'd flip through a book again going, oh, wow, I should read this again. But I don't want to take the 20 hours to read the whole book again. Really, I just want to get the highlights again. So I figured in the moment I'm reading it, this is where I need to save the most important lessons from this book. So I started saving all those text files, and I would do things like I would copy them to my phone. So even if I was just sitting on the bus for an hour, I could review my notes on the bus. And then I started posting them on my website. So if you go to sivers.org/book, sivers.org/book, you'll see all of my book notes. I just started sharing them publicly with links to go get the whole book if you're interested. And now I have this idea of wanting to sum up the most important things I've learned from the last 200 and whatever 25 books that I've read, and think of what were the most important, powerful points that I've learned and put them all together.
I think that's a very worthwhile project, and I'm looking forward to what you come up with. Let's move on to the second question, if you don't mind. The second question is, Derek, what is your strength and how are you using it to bring joy to yourself and to others?
I don't really think in terms of strengths. Only in terms of what interests me. I think strengths is like a later analysis, mm-hmm. if you know what I mean. Like,
yep.
When somebody says, what are your strengths? I have to think back to the last 20 compliments I've received and try to find a common thread and go, well, people really seem to like this, so I guess that's my strength. Mm-hmm. Or people have told me I'm good at that, so I guess that's my strength. But in the moment, it's not really something I ever think about. So because of that, I tend to think of myself as a programmer, a student, because I just spend a lot of time just learning, and an entrepreneur. Like, I like to make systems that hopefully help people. Mm-hmm. But when I think back to the compliments I've received, what other people have told me made a big difference to them, it was always my writing. And by writing, I guess I mean anything I've written, even if I get on stage and say it later, I still just consider that writing. So even my company, CD Baby, was quite successful, and I was the sole programmer and the sole founder, so therefore the entrepreneur. But in hindsight, CD Baby wasn't successful because of my programming or my business savvy. It was always my writing. People loved what I had to say about the struggles of being an independent musician. They loved the words associated with the business. So what is my strength? I guess I'm a writer.
Yeah, I'd like to second that notion. I think your writing, at least in the book that I read, Anything You Want, was very straightforward. It was very not fluffy. It was no nonsense. It was very meaty. And, you know, just to go one more level deeper in complimenting you about your writing is, as a reader, the keeping things dense is much appreciated. And I think that you're able to take ideas, strip away all the inessentials, and present it in such a way that's not couched in caveats or disclaimers or whatnot. And that's why I think your words hit me so hard, is because I started a company earlier in January because I wanted to do something that I loved and hopefully somebody would buy it. You know, I was basically doing everything wrong from the perspective of usually people will go out and see what's needed, a service that maybe people will pay for, and then adapt their product to that. But I was like, I just want to do something I love and hopefully it sells. And so when I read your book, I was like, oh man, you know, it was a bit of a shock to reality. And I knew everything you were saying was good. It was viable advice. And so I much appreciate it. I'm adapting as we speak now, my business plan, but I think your writing, yeah, is a strength. And I'm glad that your interests of learning and being a student and entrepreneur are basically kind of fruits from this writing, or your writing is fruits from that interest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. No problem, Derek. So let's move to the third one. Now, the third one's kind of just to keep things light, maybe learn a little bit more about you. The third question is if you have maybe a funny joke or maybe an embarrassing experience that you've had in your life that makes you smile, if maybe you could share something like that.
I think they all do. I mean, when I was a teenager, I just built the habit of asking, whenever anything goes wrong, I ask, what's great about this? It's a habit that I deliberately cultivated, and it didn't come easy at first. Like, usually I'd forget to ask it because I'd be in a bad mood. You know, something's gone really wrong and you're just in a foul mood. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I would just not remember to ask this at all. Or I'd remember a couple days later, I'd say, what's great about this? And of course, in the moment, I always say, well, nothing's great about this. This is awful. Mm-hmm. And then I think, okay, well, actually, all right, if I'm being open-minded, okay, it does have this upside. But so, you know, at first it would take me a couple days to remember to ask myself that question. After a couple years, I noticed that I was asking that question, say, an hour after something went wrong. And eventually, after training myself, it became an instant reaction. So it's like the very second something goes wrong, I find myself just instinctually asking, what's great about this? So, yeah, I'm usually the one to laugh whenever I make a huge mistake, whether it's dropping dinner all over the floor, getting involved with the wrong woman, or shutting down a business that nobody wanted, as we discussed earlier.
And obviously you have to be very creative at times to find what's great about it. Whether, like you said, dropping something on the floor. With the Wood Egg Company, Did it take you longer because of all that investment and sunk costs into that before you found something great about it?
No. Luckily, I mean, I had the right mindset going into that one, that I was not doing it to make money. Kind of like I described earlier, I did it just for my own learning. Mm-hmm. And I also, at the time, thought I was going to continue living in Singapore for 20 years. And I didn't know that life would swirl me around and send me to New Zealand and Belgium instead. I'm still a legal resident of Singapore, and I hope to live there again someday. But at the time, I thought it was going to be my sole home for 20 years. So I really wanted to like immerse myself deeply in this subject. So I wasn't doing it for the money. So when the books didn't sell, it was just kind of a shrug, like, oh, well, whatever. That's okay. I did it for my own personal interest reasons. I think at this point in my life, a lot of things I do are just for my own personal interests. If nobody else is interested in the things I've created, it doesn't bother me so much.
That's nice. At least from my perspective, definitely protects your ego, because my ego is often bruised and damaged because I have so much hope that, you know, it's going to be well received. And I wrote a book earlier in January with the launch of my company, and I'm not selling very many books because I guess I wrote this book and the level of math and the derivation of the equations I did was just well above even my colleagues. And I had written this book for a 15-year-old, and I'm like, oh, I need to change things on my next book. But yeah, for you to separate yourself from that project, I can kind of see why it wasn't hard for you to laugh it off or see what was great about that.
Excellent. You know, songwriting is kind of like, I hadn't thought about it this way before. Songwriting is almost like micro entrepreneur training, because when you're a songwriter, you write a new song every week or two, and you write it and you record it and you play it for your friends. And sometimes you have all kinds of hopes, like you think like, oh my God, this is the best song I've ever written. And you play it for your friends and they go like, I don't know. I like your other one better. You go, wow, okay. And other times you just pop out a little ditty that you're not too thrilled about. And your friends go, whoa, I love this one. This is my favorite song you've ever written. You say, what? Like that one? Like that was just some silly little effortless thing that just came out. And they're like, oh, no, this is the best song you've ever written. So I hadn't thought about that comparison before, that yeah, as a songwriter, you do this 100 times. A lot of songwriters have easily written 100 songs, and you don't get too attached to any one idea. You put it out there and you move on, and you're kind of a little disconnected from how the world is going to respond to it. You just kind of learn to shrug. So I think entrepreneurial pursuits have to be a little bit like that too. Like you just do lots of things, you put it out into the world. Sometimes the world isn't into it. Sometimes they're into something that you didn't think was a big deal. And it's a certain mindset to get into. Yeah.
I appreciate you mentioning that, because I think it's a fine balance when you create something as a artistic person, whether it's songwriting or art, and you think it's wonderful and somebody poo-poos on it, so to speak, you take it very personal. And I guess the advice that you would share with people like that, people like me, would, and tell me if this is accurate, just create many different works of art and not invest your feelings or expectations into others, and you won't suffer the arrows and slings of people who don't like your work?
Yeah, it's learning to disconnect from it a bit, in the sense of, you know, when they say like you release an album, you release a book, mm-hmm. you release a movie. I like that we use the English word release for that, because it is like a letting go. Like, it doesn't belong to you anymore. It's out there in the world and you created it for whatever reason you did. But the world is going to respond the way they want. It's theirs now.
I like that. I like that term, release. I think Picasso said something to the effect that you spend your life finding your talent or passions, and then you spend the rest of your life giving them away.
Nice. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, cool. Excellent. That was a good segue into this. So, do you have a favorite quote? And if so, if you do have a favorite quote, could you tell us it and maybe why you like it so much?
Probably, whatever scares you, go do it. I just think it's a good compass in life to delegate your actions to that rule of thumb, and it can help unparalyze you in those moments of fear.
Has there been maybe an example in your life where something scared you, you've done it, and just kind of was a remarkable event for you?
All the time. I mean, it can be on the big, big, big level. Like to me, when I was 39 years old and I felt like, okay, I've spent the first 40 years of my life in the U.S. I want to spend the next 40 years out. And I know it'll be scary and I know it'll be challenging, but yeah, therefore go do it, you know? I mean, so I do it on the big level sometimes like that, just whenever I'm making a decision. That's what I mean. That's why I call it a compass. It's like whenever you're faced with a decision, ask yourself, like, is this scaring me? Therefore, that's the correct thing to do. But even on a micro level, you know, catching yourself in the moment scared to go talk to this intimidating girl or whatever, you know. If you notice that you're scared of someone, well, that's probably a good sign that you should go talk to them. Things like that. So big or small.
Amazing. I love that. Who said that? I think I have that quote on a poster in my bathroom. I mean, I'm embarrassed to admit that, but yeah, I have quotes in my bathroom, but it sounds like something like Mark Twain or Ralph Waldo Emerson would have said. I think that's an excellent quote.
Yeah, to me, it was something that you know, I'd heard somebody say when I was 18 years old, this guy, Mark Fried, who was working at BMI at the time and later founded Spirit Music Publishing. He was, he was an important guy in my life. And yeah, he said it. He said, whatever scares you, go do it. Or no, actually, he didn't. He said, whatever you're thinking, go do it. Huh, I forgot about that. Yeah, he said, whatever you think. Anyway, So yeah, it doesn't matter who said things. You know, we can just put in anything in quotes and write Mark Twain after it if that makes us feel better about it.
That's good. That's true. You have on your website even confessed that you're an introvert. And I like to think of myself as an introvert. I actually look forward to the day I can Saturday morning get up, do my podcasting or my art or writing a book. Is that true? Are you an introvert like that?
Yeah. I used to think I was more 50-50. People who kind of encounter me in person think I'm a big extrovert because I'm socially skilled, but those are skills that I cultivated out of necessity. Mm-hmm. And so I used to think I was more 50-50. So one time I was working with this guy who asked me if I was introvert or extrovert, and I said, no, I'm both. I'm really 50-50. And he said, well, let me ask you this. Where do you go to recharge your batteries? I said, oh, well, alone, obviously. And he said, see, not obviously. He said, I'm an extrovert. He said, if I'm alone for too long, I get really run down. He said, I need to go be around people to kind of recharge my batteries. Mm. I went, whoa, I can't even imagine that. Yeah. I said, people are draining. I said, no, alone is something I could do forever. Being around other people, that's something I can do for like a few hours or maybe a few days tops. And he said, oh, you're an introvert. So to me, that's all it's really about. I mean, I like people in small doses, but I love being alone.
I hear you. I can resonate with that. And I like that, I guess, that method of determining which you are, because some people definitely do recharge with more people around. And to me, it's an effort to be social. But like you say, you know, you develop those for survival skills because we live in a world that really prioritizes the two levels. And I would dare say that extroverted people are looked at in a more favorable light. But yeah, excellent. Good. Well, I'm glad to know I'm with friends of the same mentality. Mm-hmm. So, Derek, the last question or two. They're kind of a connected question. The last one is, what do you see in the world today that gives you hope in humanity and in our future?
I don't really think in terms of humanity. And honestly, I don't even look at the man-made world so much these days. I live in New Zealand now, quite intentionally, surrounded by nature. And I spend my work time just programming and writing, which is quite inward focused. You know, I'm not really looking at what other people are doing or trying to get hope in humanity or something like that. I spend all my non-work time hanging with my kid on the beach and climbing rocks and playing in the forest and swimming and doing stuff like outside in the real world. And I don't know. So yeah, I'm not really looking to the world to give me hope in humanity and in our future. I don't know. I'm not thinking those terms.
No, I love your response. I think that I formulated this question on my way back from Taiwan. Fortunately for my job, I get to travel the world and see different cultures all over the world. And I had read some article that just really depressed me. And I wrote this question and intended to ask everybody on this podcast so that they could tell me why I should be excited, because I was really depressed at that time. And I like that you've disconnected your reliance on this. Maybe I need to practice that. But yeah, thanks for sharing that, Derek.
Well, you know, it's if you're granted, this is a talk about very American traits. It's feeling self-sufficient. You know, self-sufficiency is very American. but you know, if you're feeling quite self-sufficient, like I don't really need the world to do much for me. You know, that's why I don't really like living in cities. I think cities are often best for people who require entertainment. You know, they want the world to entertain them. They say, "Oh, I love the city. It's exciting. There's so much going on." But like, I don't need anything to go on. My happiest times in my life have been when I'm just living in the middle of nowhere. When I was 22 years old, I moved to the Oregon coast and I lived in a town with a population of 2. While I was there, the population was 3. And you know, I would go walking on the beach every day for sometimes, you know, 3 to 5 hours. I wouldn't see another person all day long. And that was my kind of life. You know, it's like, I don't need the world to do something for me to give me hope. It's like, no, this world is good as it is. And I'm good as I am. And I'm doing things that I like doing. I don't need other people to make me happy. But, you know, you also asked about, like, what kind of legacy want to leave future generations. But I found that I also don't think in terms of legacy, because I don't really care what anyone thinks of me after I die. I think a lot of people really, some people are driven by that idea. You know, Trump putting his name all over things. I mean, not even just even ignoring whatever, you know, silly politics stuff is going on now. But I just mean, like, that's somebody that's always made a point of making sure that his name is on things, and he wants that name Trump to go down in history for many generations. And even so do people, whatever, Carnegie's, people that want to put their names on things. But there are other people that have done amazing things for the world, and we don't know their names because they didn't make a point of leaving a legacy. They didn't care. And often they just are happy to let someone else take the spotlight. So that said, I do think that recording your thoughts, whether in writing, audio, or video, and then publicly sharing what you've learned is one of the best things you can do for the world.
Awesome. I think if anybody's benefited from listening to your knowledge and advice, it would be me. I think it was very therapeutic. You may want to start a company where you're, you know, like a shrink. For people like me, I love, Derek, that you insist on being disconnected. And that's kind of something that I need to hear. So I appreciate you mentioning that. I really love your personality and the insights. I would like to thank you for being on our show.
Oh, thanks, Nate. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Derek, and have a good one. It's been a pleasure.
You too. Thanks, Nate. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And there you have it, everyone. I hope you enjoyed it. I'd like to thank our supporters. This podcast was made possible in part by Tall Tales Engineering.
You can check out their website at tataengr.com. That's tataengr.com. We would also like to thank our audio engineer, Kai. Have a spectacular day, everyone. Ta-ta for now.
If you have enjoyed this Mile High Podcast Club experience, please consider subscribing to our podcast on iTunes or Podomatic.com and leaving a review. If you think your friends and family might benefit from these inspiring stories, feel free to tell them about our podcast and send them to our website, which is smilehighpodcast.com. Thanks for listening, and this podcast was made possible in part by Tall Tales Engineering. Tall Tales Engineering is a company wholly devoted to teaching our next generation's children about science and engineering. The secret of its success is that it uses Tall Tales to teach engineering secrets to youngsters of all ages. A book currently available is Fever Fever in Spillage Village. This is a tale about a young alligator named Archie, whose village is taken over by killer fish, beaver hybrid animals. In order to save the town from certain disaster, he has to use math and science to lure the fevers back in their cage. In this book, children will be taught how Archie uses the buoyancy principle to save the day. There's one catch, however. If his engineering calculations are off just one bit, the fevers will get him and all will be lost. Look for this book on Amazon or any other major retailer near you. Thank you and enjoy your show.